What's one mistake that you see private equity firms or portfolio companies making, and what actions would you suggest to correct them?
Yeah, the most obvious one is, it sounds kind of totally backwards what people think, is go too slow, right? As soon as I get my hands on the new company, our first meeting is the goal meeting. And the goal meeting is nothing more than math. And the thing I love about private equity, it's all about what is the return that you need to get in order for it to be successful for everyone involved. So, and we start doing those actions, and it's really all driven out of the data. You have to grow this business. Remember, private equity, we have one goal, and what's that goal?
For absolute cracker, we have Bill Kennedy, CEO of OTC Industrial Technologies. Welcome back to the Raw Selection Private Equity Podcast. Joining us today is Bill Kennedy, CEO of OTC Industrial Technologies, and also CEO of Arrowhead Engineered Products, both backed by private equity. Welcome, Bill, and thank you very much for sharing your insights.
Hey, thank you. It's great to be here.
So, Bill, as is customary, if you could give us a 60 to 90 second breakdown of you, please.
Well, as you said, I'm CEO of two different companies and started out with OTC. Our private equity sponsor is a wonderful company called Genstar, and they're San Francisco based and probably the best ones I've ever worked for. We took over OTC, got the company turned around, and took it from about $700 million to over $1 billion in a couple of years. And the reward that you get when you do really well is you get more work, right? So Arrowhead is a great company as well. It's going through kind of a bit of a rough time. And they brought myself and my CFO in to help out there, and it's really responding. It's got a great team. It's focused in a little bit different area. It is focused primarily in power sports and outdoor power equipment. But at the end of the day, you know, great products, good people, trying to give a superior return to our partners is really what we're all about. And we're pretty excited to have that. As far as myself personally, I live in Florida, down in Sarasota area, and have over 100 locations across the United States. So me being in one location or not doesn't really matter. I just travel. And Arrowhead's a global company. We're in about 50 different countries. So been married 31 years to the same amazing woman. What she sees in me, I will never know. Got two fabulous daughters. One's getting ready to be a dentist, Sarah, getting married in March, and the other one just became a new mom. So I got my first grandson, a little Colin Arthur. So Hannah's the proud parent of him. So I'm living a truly blessed journey.
Absolutely. Sounds it. And congratulations on being being a grandparent to both you and your wife. So what's one mistake that you see private equity firms or portfolio companies making, and what actions would you suggest to correct them?
Yeah, the most obvious one is, it sounds kind of totally backwards what people think, is go too slow, right? They come in and they're trying to figure out exactly where things are at. And while I'm not suggesting any of us have the answers, you do have to go learn that. But you need a process, a series of questions, a series of way of getting at the data. And a lot of times people will take the first 6 months and just figure out where the bathroom's at, figure out who's on first base. There is a lot of benefit with that, but private equity, the thing I love about it, it's all about the return. And the return is driven off of many things, one of those being time. And when you come in as a new CEO or you just bought it as a sponsor, everything gets shaken up and you have a limited window where you can really make great changes. So you got to be thoughtful, you got to be careful, but you got to go fast. You got to figure out where the profit pools are, and you need a very thoughtful, systematic way to get through it.
Love that. And the obvious question, Bill, is you mentioned you've working with a private equity firm that's obviously brought you in on two platforms. You're the first person I've ever heard that's CEO of two businesses that are both backed by the same private equity firm. Why isn't one enough? And how the hell are you managing two instead of one?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. So it's just kind of a quirk of the times, right? A few years ago, there's no way I could have done this, right? I'd have to be in the headquarters and with the team and all that. But today, almost all my leadership team is virtual. I didn't set it up that way. It was set up that way before I got there. If you go to the Arrowhead, our headquarters in Blaine, Minnesota, got a giant building there, about 500,000 square foot, probably about 25,000 of that is headquarters. I think there's 10 people in the whole thing, right? During the pandemic, people moved to Knoxville and Florida and you name it, all over Colorado. Same thing in OTC. It's a small headquarters. And there is my partner, CFO, Adam is there. His team is there, a little bit of HR. Otherwise, everyone else has gone remote. So go back 5 years ago, no way that this is happening. But today with technology and what we're after and where we're going, this is absolutely possible. In fact, not only is it possible, we're making it work. The second thing I think that that we bring to the table is we have a process on how we approach things. That process really doesn't care what the product is. It's really about, are we focused where the money's at? Do we have our resources aligned where that's at? I certainly won't be CEO of both of them for forever. This was an opportunity to help Genstar out, help the company out, come in, stabilize the business. I'm sure in the next foreseeable future, at least one of these will get someone else back in there and get it going. But it's working great. And it's working great really for only one reason, and that's the team. We have great people on both of them. They care deeply. They get up each and every day, and their mind is focused on making these companies better. We want to give exceptional opportunities to our folks. We want to be great partners to our customers and our vendors, and we want to give a superior return to our partners out there, particularly our investors, right? And that's where we kind of drive everything around. So it's the team that's making it happen, and I'm just proud to be part of it.
Excellent. And you mentioned a lot of it's down to the processes that you use. What's some of those processes that have allowed you to be a chief exec? You mentioned one is getting the right team around you, and no doubt you've got a process for that. But what's some of the things that you've done that's allowed you to Genstar to go, let's take Bill, let's get him doing this as well as getting doing that as well?
Yeah, we have a very thoughtful process. We show up, we do what we call the 100-day process. We walk in on day one. And we have a series of four meetings we're going to hold, right? As soon as I get my hands on the new company, our first meeting is the goal meeting. And the goal meeting is nothing more than math. And the thing I love about private equity, it's all about what is the return that you need to get in order for it to be successful for everyone involved. So, you know, in public companies, it's an infinity horizon. You lurch from quarter to quarter and you'll die for a penny, right? In private companies, these are value-driven companies. And it's whatever the value of the owner is. If the owner's values have a bigger boat, then you're going to be buying boats. If it's taking care of the town and the people in it, then you're going to be taking care of the town and be very parochial in your approach. Private equity is all about getting a superior return. So since we know what that is, and it's driven by contracts, we take the EBITDA that we need in order to get a reasonable return on our invested capital. We call that MOIC, or multiple on invested capital. And we're typically wanting to see something 3x or greater. You take where you are, you take what you think that business will sell for, you do the math, that's your goal. There's no discussion about it. It just kind of is. And since all the leadership team is typically tied in with some type of incentive program, options or shares or whatever, everybody wants the same thing. They want to maximize that result. So the first meeting is a goal meeting, and it's picking how big we have to be. And we also in that meeting will decide how much of that is organic we believe we'll go get and how much of it is acquisition. So do we have enough dry powder to get us there? The second thing we decide in that meeting is timing, right? We'll say, well, we're at 100 today. In order to get where we need to be 200. Based on what we think growth looks like, we need 3 years or 5 years. And we try to make it as aggressive as possible, what we think we can live with. So cautiously optimistic is probably the best way to think about it. Second meeting is the strategy. Given our goal, what's the strategy we think we're going to do in order to get there? Now, the strategy is right in the core. So if you're making industrial pumps, something that we do a lot of, we're not looking at restaurants. We're not thinking about how to go buy planes or anything like that. How do we make more pumps in the markets that we're in? Define the strategy from it. Third meeting is structure. This is where most companies I've seen have failed at is they'll have a great strategy, a magnificent strategy, but they don't organize themselves around to actually go do that strategy. People wind up with their day job, what they've been doing, and also this other job to go do the strategy. We will reorganize ourselves. We'll put leaders over it. We'll make sure we have as small a corporate staff as possible. But the people out there, we typically, our strategies are getting back to basics. We re-energize the company. We make sure we've got folks out there who we need and the business needs to be successful. Then a final meeting is our action meeting, or our tactical meeting, where we say, here is our goal, our strategy, our structure. What are the steps that we got to go take in order to go start executing? Now, because we move so fast in that first 100 days, we're kind of a puddle, right? We're an inch deep and a mile wide. But remember, these people who were working with the company, many of them have been there sometimes for decades, but certainly for longer than I have. So we're pulling the knowledge out of them. We're getting them aligned. At the same time we're doing this, we hold a series of three meetings with the entire company, town hall sessions or all-hand meetings, if you will. So we announce what we're doing within the first couple of weeks, have an all-hands meeting. We give them a checkup in the middle. And then at the end, we announce out the launch and we show the org charts and everything. So it's funny, if you're involved in it, it feels like you're going a million miles an hour. It's coming at you fast. The rest of the company feels a little bit left behind, like nothing's happening. So this helps us knit everything together. So that's our first 100 days. We call that our stub year, right? And then from there, we quickly shift into what we call earn the right to grow. And so that's our first full year where we take the actions that we said we were going to go do, and we start doing those actions. And it's really all driven out of the data. Everything's driven out. There's no mystery. We're not looking at it and trying to come up with something new. It's the data tells us this, and we start shifting our way towards it. And we have a process for that. So that's how we do it. That's how we kick off.
What are the, so you mentioned, as you would call it, data, as I would call it, data. What are the data points that you predominantly look at that drive the actions that obviously drive the growth and drive the strategy and the vision that you've set?
I branded this operating model, calling it a profitable growth operating system. But really what it is, the heart of it is 80-20. So, you know, we all learned about it in grade school with Pareto. And the real simple piece of it is 80% of your results, 80% of the company's results come out of 20% of what they do. So with that in mind, we are putting together simple Excel charts. People always say, we don't have the data. Every company I've been a part of has too much data. And frankly, it's just they don't have it organized in a way. And if you're in private equity, you buy all these companies, you put them together, and there's so many different systems. And, you know, one of the natural things people will say is, well, I need to put an ERP in, or I need a BI system or something like that. And maybe they do, and maybe it will help them. But to get the data on what to act, I've never seen one yet that we can't pull into Excel, run macros on it, because we don't have, it's not brain surgery, right? So we're not trying to be that precise. We need directions on where we're going. So as we look at the data or the data, we really only look at two things in depth. And one of those is the customers, and the second one is the products. And the traditional way of doing it, people will look at it one-dimensionally. They'll look at their pricing, as an example, do some type of scatter plot and look for the outliers, say, well, we should raise that or should go from there. We look at it through the lens of both. So we do a two-dimensional, and we'll say, what are our A customers? What are our best customers buying, right? And then secondly, so what are the best products that they have? So our best customers buy our best products. But guess what? They also buy products that we don't really like selling. We don't make a lot of money on. Those are B products. Then we have B customers that are not very meaningful for us. And typically that means they just don't buy very much, or they don't pay their bills, or whatever it is. There's not a true relationship there. So these B customers, well, guess what? They actually buy great products, right? They buy products, our A products. And then the final dimension is B customers buy B products. So customers that we're not enamored of buy products that we cannot figure out how to make money. And the whole secret of this thing, the whole secret is you identify your B customers and your B products, and you take the resources from those and you put those on your A customers and your A products. This is how you grow it without having to go back to your partners and say, I need more capital. Because if you look at your cost structure typically falls 25% in each bucket, right? So you got 25% of your people working on good customers and good products, and all the way around for each one of those quadrants I mentioned. We want to automate as much as possible. We want to do things like raise minimum orders. We want to raise prices. You can only take the order online. Whatever we can do to try to take people's time and put it over there around our best customers. And we know our best customers love us. Do you know how we know that?
Love to know.
They buy from us, and they buy a lot from us. And because we're so important to them, they actually pay their bills. When you're selling millions of dollars to someone, they're going to pay their bills, because if they don't, they go out of business. When you take a B customer, they typically are someone else's A customer. They're only buying things from us they can't get from their best vendors. And if things go bad, they don't pay us, right? They get terms. They buy only the weird things from us that we can't figure out how to make money on either. So because of that, it's okay if we start moving away from them, because when you run the math, about 80 to 90% of all the money you're making is out of those A customers and A products. And when you actually look at it, 200% of your profit comes from your A customers, 200%. Now, think about it for a second. We only get 100% of the money, right? We only get the full amount. So if you're making 200%, that means you're losing money in the other areas. And where you're losing money, the vast majority of the money you're losing is in the B customer, B products, because 4% of your revenue on average comes out of that fourth quadrant, but 25% of your costs are sitting there. So just by exiting that, or getting rid of that, or minimizing that, you automatically quit losing more money. How many times have you seen someone said, every time I sell a product, I staple a $100 bill to it and I ship it out, but I need to do it. And for all sorts of reasons, we try to avoid that. We take those costs, we put it over there around a customer that likes us and values us, and pays us lots of money.
How difficult is that as a mindset to, because we deal with portfolio companies across Europe and North America, and cutting customers is for a lot of them is not a decision-making process that comes at the table. It's how do we win more customers? How do we develop these customers? Now, you caveat that at the start by saying we try and automate as much as we can, but it sounds like there's a level of going, you're not our ideal customer, you know, we want to focus on our top ones and therefore you'll lose them. Was that something you've always had, Bill, or is that a mindset you've had to develop through obviously looking at those numbers and looking at the data?
It is not a natural mindset for sure, right? We want all customers. We want them all. We love them all. Please bring your friends, right? But the reality of it is mathematically, it doesn't work. And you can show it. It's just there. It's like physics, right? You can think and believe and all what you want, but when you look at the data, it's going to show you you're not making money here. Now you have a decision to make because you have to grow this business. Remember, private equity, we have one goal. And what's that goal?
Make a business to an exit.
Make money, right? We got to get this multiple up as far as where it's going to be. Our goal is to make money, get it to the exit as fast as we can. There's no pot of gold. When the private equity company buys you, you get a certain amount of dry powder. You get your small amount. Everything you do has to be self-funding, right? If they put more money in, it dilutes everyone. And everyone sitting around that table means they will make less money. So if you are so enamored of doing something, you're willing to ask for more. It's like going to your parents and asking for money. What happens when you go to your parents and ask for money?
My history was get stuffed.
Yeah, it's painful, right? They'll give it to you, but you have a painful lesson. Every time you see your money, it's like, what'd you do, Alex? Well, it's the same thing in private equity. They typically, if they have it, it makes sense. They'll give it to you, but it's painful. You get diluted. Your horizon goes out. You actually have to sell more. There's no free lunch here. You have to self-generate it if you're going to make the return. The data is 100% clear. No one can argue with it. What they will argue with is the emotional side of it. They'll tell you things like, no, this is a great customer. I'm telling you, they're going to go. Then you look at the data and it turns out none of these ever really go. There's a rare exception, right? There's always this, but it doesn't happen. But you try to work your way through it, right? You have to be able to hold competing thoughts in your head as you're doing this. And so the person comes to you and says, hey, I need to do this. All right, well, let's set a window on this, right? You can have 6 months. If it doesn't work, we're exiting, or on and on and on. So the reality is we don't actually fire customers. We don't focus on that at all. What we do is we say things like, your minimum order is now bigger. I'll give you a great example on Arrowhead. So Arrowhead, we went through the pandemic, sales boomed like crazy. Everybody wanted scooters and motorcycles and you name it, right? And but then things slowed down, right? And so because the pandemic slowed, people went back to work, right? And they spent a lot of the money they had. As we looked at it, we had taken more and more customers. So the customer, one of the classic examples of a customer was we had what we call bunny slipper customers. So these were people who'd set up a website, right, in their home, and they would put it out there at a very low margin, just looking to get, you know, single digit profitability just by simply placing an order, putting a website, someone to place it. They'd place the order with us and we would drop ship it to the customer. And they would take just a few points. You go, well, what's wrong with that, right? Well, there's several things wrong. First of all, the only reason dealers or distributors exist in our world is two things. They have to have inventory. They got to get inventory close to the customers. And the second reason is credit risk, right? And so what they were doing is taking no inventory in, taking an order, and then shipping that order direct to the customer. So let's say we were going to do a pallet full of items and there's 100 items on a pallet. That takes one person. We can pack the pallet. We put it on a truck. We ship it to one location, right? We collect it from one person. We can do okay with that. When you take that same pallet, you explode it out. Now I've got 100 orders I got to place. I got to have 100 different trucks come pick it up. It's going to different locations. And I have to collect from 100 different people. My odds of being successful are not only much smaller, it costs me substantially more. I need more people in my factory. I need more people in shipping. I need more people in collection. It goes on and on. So it really drives your business into a very tough spot. So as the leader, what's the first decision you make if you want to get yourself back profitable on that scenario? Do you fire the customer? Probably not. But what you do is you raise your minimum shipping. You say, I'm happy to ship it to you, but you got to have a pallet full. Now, all of a sudden, this customer who has no value, I'm no value to him. I'm just some website he's linked to. Now he's committed to me, right? It's like a ham and egg breakfast. The chicken drops an egg off, the ham leaves meat on the plate, right? We need pigs in our business. We want people who are committed. That person committed. He's got a pallet full of my material in his warehouse. He's got to go sell that. We're better partners, right? I don't have to go sell it. And I can make money. And guess what? He can make money. But he doesn't. In the other way, I'm just a transaction for him. So I didn't fire him. I just said, if you want to continue buying from me, you've got to make yourself large enough, because I'm not running a mom and pop business, right? And this business has 4,000 employees, give or take 4,000 employees, $1.5 billion sales, 50 countries. I can't sell one item at the time. We could, but our model's not set up for it. So did I fire him? You could argue I did. I just said, if you want to take and continue getting it, you've got to place a bigger order. However, if you don't want to do that, I also have a deal with Amazon where we will buy truckloads of material, and you can buy from Amazon all you want all day. Amazon's happy. We love them. We're happy. They're happy. The customer gets what he wants, and they are set up to deliver one item at the time and do it in hours in some cases.
You're just basically reducing the opportunity for the smaller businesses to trade with you. And if they're going to trade, they're going to do it in a larger quantity rather than one-off and having all these shipping charges. So you're just basically making it difficult for the smaller firms to use you as a smaller business rather than using you as a large organization, which you are, to utilize it properly.
Yeah, because what's happened is technology has allowed individuals to disintermediate the people above them, right? So imagine if you go to the manufacturer, you go grocery shopping, why not go to whoever's making your yogurt or your milk and buying it right from the farm, right? Why not? Well, the reason is they're not set up for it. Our factories and our warehouses are not set up to do millions of orders. We're set up to do thousands of orders. In order to do that, I've got to put in sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars on it. And so it really doesn't matter the size of business, right? What matters is, how is your business set up, and can you handle it? If you're going to get out of your lane and you're going to go and say, hey, I'm going to be a big business. You know, it's interesting. If you look at how business works, it starts out. So Alex, you and I get together. We like each other. We're going to start a business. I'll take anyone, right? We have to. It's how you get started. Unless you got some new whiz bang, and you grow and you grow. And all of a sudden you go, my God, the complexity is extraordinary. I've got hundreds of items, thousands of items. When I took over OTC, how many SKUs do you think we had? You want a SKU? Like, how many different items did we sell? 8 million. 8 million different SKUs. The average business.
8 million is a lot.
It's too many. You can't make any money on it. So today, we're certainly down below 2 million, but our primary business is around about 250,000 different items, stock keeping items, SKUs, right? So you got to know what you are. I love salesmen. I started out as a salesman. This is how I made my living for years and years. And I've never met a customer I didn't like, because I got commission off all of them. Plus, I like people, like dealing with it. But as a business, there is, whatever your model is, however you're set up, is where you're going to make your most money. And you can be set up in any of these, but bigger orders are where you're going to want to do it. It's the same way in your recruiting business, right? You are much better off if you can find one company who needs hundreds of people and you can get a very good relationship where it's going, versus having hundreds of clients that all buy one.
Yeah, makes sense. Although there's never a private equity firm that needs a lot of chief exec, CFO, COOs. Absolutely, for the portfolio, and we can support that. Rather than having 20 different ones, it can make it more complex. When you understand cultures and backgrounds, you're absolutely right. And it's same when you've got that on the product level for your SKUs and driving that down, but also the right customers as well.
So back to your original point. So the way it works is, I when I come in with a business, I don't have any preconceived notion. They can be wherever they want to be in the value chain, all that. What we try to identify, and the math tells us, this is where we make our money. We know we make money here. We can run it. It's absolutely empirical. No mystery at all. Then what gets interesting, as soon as we have the data, the team will argue about it forever, right? They go, oh, you don't, it's not really that way. But the things that we know is, when I show up and people like me show up, we're not showing up because things are going great. Generally, we're showing up because it wasn't quite going the way they wanted. And if it had been, whoever was leading it would still be in it and still running it, right? So we show up, we get the data. Now, armed with that data, we start figuring out where to go. My goal as a CEO is nothing more than to say, this is our mission. This is our hill we're going to take. This is our goal. And the goal is irrefutable, because the goal everyone around that table has already committed to, because it's private equity. You know exactly what you have to get to in order to get to a return that's acceptable for everyone. You remember the book, Good to Great?
Jim Collins,
it's a wonderful book, right? Private equity is good to go on. We want to get it, fix it, get it going, and sell it. In order to make it worth your while, you need to know what your exit point is.
Excellent. I really appreciate that insight, Bill. Thank you very much. I've learned a lot there, certainly. So you've written, I don't know if you released any yet, but you can tell us if you have, but I understand you've written multiple books and they're all scheduled to be released. Multiple is quite a surprising one from the bat to be scheduled to be released. What made you think about writing multiple books to be scheduled rather than writing one book and then writing the next one once you've released it?
That's a great question. Probably because it might be slightly crazy. But the reality of it is, so I talked a little bit about the model that we've used. And if you look at it, it's based, the core of it's off Pareto's principle, 80-20. Mm-hmm. And I learned how to do that about 25 years ago. And in my world, I'm sure someone else have a different view. It kind of all started with ITW. I was working for a company. The former CEO was on our board. We were having a little trouble. We could make money, but we couldn't grow. And the suggestion was look at the 80-20 model. We did, myself and a few other people with the company, wound up building out a model that we deployed across the company that we were at the time. It was very successful, right? And then that kind of became the basis as I grew my career. This model I would go and I would take with me, and it's morphed and grew, and I added my own flavors to it and everything. And I named it, whether it was 80-20 at ITW or Danaher Business System, DBS, or IDEX Operating Model, to go on and on and on. Everyone puts their own brand on them, but typically it's a few sets of specialized tools, we'd call it. And mine has the same thing, right? So there's 80-20, which is about where do you focus? Where's the money at? It's data driven. Lean's been around forever, right? It goes all the way back to Frederick Taylor about focusing on and taking waste out, all the way to Toyota Production System and on and on. There's millions of books out there. I haven't added anything to Lean, but the thing I like about Lean, and it's in my model, is 80-20 and Lean together, it doesn't get any better, because 80-20 tells you where to focus. Lean shows you how to get the waste out. The problem with Lean can be is you can take $1 million worth of lean activity to fix a nickel problem. 80-20 would say, shut the nickel problem down, get out of it, go focus where there's real profit on it. Third area, and these are in no order, talent. You got to have great people, always have to have great people. That should come warm your heart a lot, Alex. But we want people who are willing to follow a process, right? Use data versus just simply emotions. You need passion, you need drive, but you got to be data driven. Fourth piece would be strategy, right? And so strategy is in the classic sense. Our strategy is an annualized process. It's around situation assessment, framework, business plan, and then the actions. That 100 days when we kick off is nothing more than a truncated strategy plan. And then we immediately move into the annual strategy. And it helps you understand what your cadence is around your meetings and how you go from diverse thinking to focus and things like that. And then the final one, and this is where private equity excels at, is the rocket fuel, right? Mergers and acquisitions. Our job as operators is to come and get the business healthy, get it focused, get it growing organically. And then if you're with a private equity firm, they will sprinkle the gunpowder on it, which is new deals, right? And that's how you really get the force multiplier, where you can get some really exceptional returns in a short period of time. We try to focus around 3 to 5 years like everyone else. 3's better, but a lot of these things take 5 years to get through. So that's the model. I don't know that I have anything special in anyone else. It's just I use it in my own fashion.
I appreciate you sharing that. So is that spread across how many books is it? Is that the models? You've got 4 different books that separate?
Yeah, so I decided to, I was going to put it down. You know, I think it's probably just driven out of ego, right? What am I going to do with all this? And I get asked all the time, is there any books out there? And there's very few books at all on 80-20 out there. There's a lot of very generic ones, wonderful books, but they're not focused around how it applies into a business. So I started writing the book, and the first one is called Profitable Growth Operating System, Take Command of Your Business, right? But it's a little bit about me and how I got started, and then around the 100-day plan and the tool set. But in order to actually do it, you need to go deep on a couple of these. So this is how the other books got put together. So the first one is the PGOS, as I mentioned. The second book is Earn the Right to Grow. That's the detailed book on 80-20, right? It's the actually, how do you put together the spreadsheets? What does it look like? The third one is Thinking is Required. That's the strategy book. So the strategy shows you how to get through it and what the processes are and the meetings and all that, right? The fourth one, it takes three And I'm still playing with the title. I go from the golden triangle to it takes three. I'm a big three person with everything. But you do need three key people if you're going to make this work. And every time I've ever, failure is probably too strong, but I'll call it a failure, has been when we were missing one. You need a CEO that says we're going to follow the data and reorganize ourselves. Remember what you talked about before. It's easy to say, but the emotions of making the changes are super hard. You got to have a CEO who's going to do it. The second one is your operators, the people running the business. They have to actually follow the process, right? And the third one is we call it a profit, right? You need someone who's a program manager that understands 80-20 and the tool set. And you need someone who understands the strategy management process, who are actually acting as the trainers, the coaches, and all that within the business. You need those three. So you need someone to tell you how to get there, someone to do the work, and someone says the work must be done. Without any one of those, the outcome's pretty underwhelming.
When are these books coming out, though?
So the first one is going through final editing as we're speaking, and will be out in spring. Right now, I think in mid-February, right? The Earn the Right to Grow should be out in the summer of next year. And then the Thinking is Required, I'm expecting in the fall. So really, it's just a matter of getting through them. You know, it's funny, we talked early on about how things have changed. You and I are having these meetings, you know, wasn't that long ago, this wouldn't have been even possible. Same thing in publishing. Today, you can get a book out pretty quickly. For me, I really want a high quality book. So the books are basically all written, but between editing and making sure the artwork looks good and all that, it takes a lot more time than what I'm used to. So we're hopeful we'll put out three of them. And then the following year, we'd have the next three. So
sounds good.
Pretty exciting times, to say the least.
Excellent. Absolutely. You mentioned books. What are your influences? What do you read? What do you watch? What do you listen outside of writing your own books?
Yeah, I'm a huge history buff. So I grew up loving sci-fi. I still love sci-fi. I always felt like sci-fi, which was, you know, attacking outer space aliens, it was mathematically possible, right? Like, I could build a machine that way. So I always loved sci-fi. As I've gotten older, like a lot of folks, I love history, particularly World War II, and then kind of for the United States, the founding fathers. And so histories and biographies are my two things. And it's driven really out of, it's like, how did they do it? You know, how did they put it together? What was the things that they were going through? I recognize that history is written by the victors. Nonetheless, it's extraordinary when you think about World War II and everything that was happening, how the countries worked together, how we were able to take something that was pretty tough across the world, and without, and like things like the Marshall Plan and things like, we wouldn't be where we are today. So I get a lot of kicks out of that. It helps me think through where I'm going, and from people who've been there themselves. When I was in school, I had a history professor, and he said, you know, we study the past to understand the present, predict the future. And I kind of glommed onto that. I find that true today.
And if anybody wants to reach out to you, Bill, how best do they get in touch, please?
Yeah, so there's a couple ways they can do it. So one, I have a website. It's just myname.com. So it's Bill Cannady, BILLCANADY.com. Or you can send me an email at BillCannady.com. So either one of those is fine. I get emails all the time and people reach out. I'm happy to chat and help in any way possible. It's just fun being part of it.
So we'll put that both in the show notes. Well, Bill, thank you very much for joining us. Really appreciate your insight. Really appreciate the rarity of you running two organizations, sharing across your PGOS system and how that operates, how that runs, and give us an insight into how we can improve the organizations that we run and we operate. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you, Alex. It's been a real joy meeting you and learning more about what you do.
Absolutely. And as always, thank you very much for all those joining us. Of course, should you ever need support with your private equity professionals or portfolio executive hiring, please do reach out to us at Royal Selection. If you've not already, please do subscribe and you'll be notified of the next podcast that comes out, which will be every week as we transition from every 2 weeks to every week. But till the next time, keep smashing it. And thank you very much for listening.